Berger had not been able to sleep on Thursday night. She hobbled restlessly back and forth while Linda kept a watchful eye on her. Her anxiety lay like a heavy fog over the house. At 2:30, Linda managed to talk Berger into getting into bed to rest, even if she did not sleep. She heaved a sigh of relief when Berger closed her bedroom door. She opened her laptop and summarized the situation in an email to Armansky. She had scarcely sent the message before she heard that Berger was up and moving about again. At 7:30, she made Berger call SMP and take a sick day. Berger had reluctantly agreed and then fallen asleep on the living room sofa in front of the boarded-up picture window. Linda spread a blanket over her. Then she made some coffee and called Armansky, explaining her presence at the house and that she had been called in by Rosen.
"Stay there with Berger," Armansky told her, "and get a couple of hours' sleep yourself."
"I don't know how we're going to build this."
"We'll work that out later."
Berger slept until 2:30. She woke up to find Linda sleeping in a recliner on the other side of the living room. Figueroa slept late on Friday morning. She did not have time for her morning run. She blamed Blomqvist for this state of affairs as she showered and then rousted him out of bed. Blomqvist drove to Millennium, where everyone was surprised to see him up so early. He mumbled something, made some coffee, and called Erickson and Cortez into his office. They spent 3 hours going over the articles for the themed issue and keeping track of the book's progress. "Dark's book went to the printer yesterday," Erickson said. "We're going down the perfect bound trade paperback route."
"The special issue is going to be called The Lisbeth Salander Story," Cortez said. "They're bound to move the date of the trial, but at the moment it's set for Wednesday, July 13th. The magazine will be printed by them, but we haven't fixed on a distribution date yet. You can decide nearer the time."
"Good. That leaves the Zalichenko book, which right now is a nightmare. I'm calling it The Section. The first half is basically what's in the magazine. It begins with the murders of Dag and Mia, and then follows the hunt for Salander first, then Zalichenko, and then Niederman. The second half will be everything we know about The Section."
"Mika, even if the printer breaks every record for us, we're going to have to send them the files by the end of this month, at the latest," Erickson said. "Krista will need a couple of days for the layout, the typesetter, say, a week. So we have about 2 weeks left for the text. I don't know how we're going to make it."
"We won't have time to dig up the whole story," Blomqvist conceded. "But I don't think we could manage that even if we had a whole year. What we're going to do in this book is to state what happened. If we don't have a source for something, then I'll say so. If we're flying kites, we'll make that clear. So, we're going to write about what happened, what we can document, and what we believe to have happened."
"That's pretty vague," Cortez said.
Blomqvist shook his head. "If I say that a Seppo agent broke into my apartment and I can document it and him with a video, then it's documented. If I say that he did it on behalf of The Section, then that's speculation. But in the light of all the facts we're setting out, it's a reasonable speculation. Does that make sense?"
"It does."
"I won't have time to write all the missing pieces myself. I have a list of articles here that you, Henry, will have to cobble together. It corresponds to about 50 pages of book text. Malin, you're back up for Henry, just as when we were editing Dag's book. All three of our names will be on the cover and on the title page. Is that all right with you two?"
"That's fine," Erickson said. "But we have other urgent problems."
"Such as?"
"While you were concentrating on the Zalichenko story, we had a hell of a lot of work to do here."
"You're saying I wasn't available?"
Erickson nodded.
"You're right. I'm sorry."
"No need to apologize. We all know that when you're in the throes of a story, nothing else matters. But that won't work for the rest of us, and it definitely doesn't work for me. Erica had me to lean on. I have Henry, and he's an ace, but he's putting in an equal amount of time on your story. Even if we count you in, we're still two people short in editorial."
"Two?"
"And I'm not Erica. She had a routine that I can't compete with. I'm still learning this job. Monica is working her backside off, and so is Lotta. Nobody has a moment to stop and think."
"This is all temporary. As soon as the trial begins..."
"No, Mikhail. It won't be over then. When the trial begins, it'll be sheer hell. Remember what it was like during the Venestrom affair? We won't see you for 3 months while you hop from one TV interview sofa to another."
Blomqvist sighed. "What do you suggest?"
"If we're going to run Millennium effectively during the fall, we're going to need new blood. Two people at least, maybe three. We just don't have the editorial capacity for what we're trying to do. And..."
"And?"
"And I'm not sure that I'm ready to do it."
"I hear you, Malin."
"I mean it. I'm a damn good managing editor. It's a piece of cake with Erica as your boss. We said that we were going to try this over the summer. Well, we've tried it. I'm not a good editor-in-chief."
Nonsense, Cortez said.
Erickson shook her head.
I hear what you're saying, Blomquist said, but remember that it's been an extreme situation.
Erickson smiled at him sadly. You could take this as a complaint from the staff, she said. The Operations Unit of Constitutional Protection spent Friday trying to get a handle on the information they had received from Blomquist. Two of their team had moved into a temporary office at Fridhemsplan, where all the documentation was being assembled. It was inconvenient because the police intranet was at headquarters, which meant that they had to walk back and forth between the two buildings several times a day. Even if it was only a 10-minute walk, it was tiresome. By lunchtime they already had extensive documentation of the fact that both Frederick Clinton and Hans von Rottinger had been associated with the security police in the 60s and early 70s. Von Rottinger came originally from the Military Intelligence Service and worked for several years in the office that coordinated military defense with the security police. Clinton's background was in the Air Force, and he began working for the Personal Protection Unit of the Security Police in 1967. They had both left SIS. Clinton in 1971, and von Rottinger in 1973. Clinton had gone into business as a management consultant, and von Rottinger had entered the civil service to do investigations for the Swedish Atomic Energy Agency. He was based in London. It was late afternoon by the time Figueroa was able to convey to Edklinth with some certainty the discovery that Clinton's and von Rottinger's careers after they left SIS were falsifications. Clinton's career was hard to follow. Being a consultant for industry can mean almost anything at all, and a person in that role is under no obligation to report his activities to the government. From his tax returns it was clear that he made good money, but his clients were, for the most part, corporations with home offices in Switzerland or Liechtenstein, so it was not easy to prove that his work was a fabrication. Von Rottinger, on the other hand, had never set foot in the office in London where he supposedly worked. In 1973, the office building where he had claimed to be working was in fact torn down and replaced by an extension to King's Cross Station. No doubt someone made a blunder when the cover story was devised. In the course of the day, Figueroa's team had interviewed a number of people now retired from the Swedish Atomic Energy Agency. Not one of them had heard of Hans von Rottinger.
Now we know, Ed Klint said. We just have to discover what it was they really were doing.
Figueroa said, What do we do about Blomqvist?
In what sense?
We promised to give him feedback if we uncovered anything about Clinton and von Rottinger. Edklinth thought about it.
He's going to be digging up that stuff himself if he keeps at it for a while. It's better that we stay on good terms with him. You can give him what you found, but use your judgment.
Figueroa promised that she would. They spent a few minutes making arrangements for the weekend. Two of Figueroa's team were going to keep working. She would be taking the weekend off. Then she clocked out and went to the gym at St. Eric's Plan, where she spent 2 hours driving herself hard to catch up on lost training time. She was home by 7. She showered, made a simple dinner, and turned on the TV to listen to the news. But then she got restless and put on her running clothes. She paused at the front door to think. Fucking Blomqvist. She flipped open her mobile and called his Ericsson.
We found out a certain amount about von Rottinger and Clinton.
Tell me.
I will if you come over.
Sounds like blackmail, Blomqvist said.
I've just changed into jogging things to work off a little of my surplus energy, Figueroa said. Should I go now or should I wait for you?
Would it be okay if I came after 9?
That'll be fine.
At 8 on Friday evening, Salander had a visit from Dr. Jonasson. He sat in the guest chair and leaned back.
Are you going to examine me? Salander said.
No, not tonight.
Okay.
We studied all your notes today, and we've informed the prosecutor that we're prepared to discharge you.
I understand.
They want to take you over to the prison in Göteborg tonight.
So soon?
He nodded. Stockholm is making noises. I said I had a number of final tests to run on you tomorrow, and that I couldn't discharge you until Sunday.
Why's that?
Don't know. I was just annoyed they were being so pushy. Salander actually smiled. Given a few years, she would probably be able to make a good anarchist out of Dr. Anders Jonasson. In any case, he had a penchant for civil disobedience on a private level.
Frederick Clinton, Blomqvist said, staring at the ceiling above Figueroa's bed.
If you light that cigarette, I'll stub it out in your navel, Figueroa said.
Blomqvist looked in surprise at the cigarette he had extracted from his jacket.
Sorry, he said.
Could I borrow your balcony?
As long as you brush your teeth afterwards.
He tied a sheet around his waist. She followed him to the kitchen and filled a large glass with cold water. Then she leaned against the door frame by the balcony.
Clinton first?
If he's still alive. He's a link to the past.
He's dying. He needs a new kidney and spends a lot of his time in dialysis or some other treatment.
But he's alive. We should contact him and put the question to him directly. Maybe he'll talk.
No,
Figueroa said.
First of all, this is a preliminary investigation and the police are handling it. In that sense, there is no we about it. Second, you're receiving this information in accordance with your agreement with Edclinth, but you've given your word not to take any initiatives that could interfere with the investigation.
Blomqvist smiled at her.
Ouch, he said. The security police are pulling on my leash.
He stubbed out his cigarette.
Mikhail, this is not a joke.
Berger drove to the office on Saturday morning, still feeling queasy. She had thought she was beginning to come to grips with the actual process of producing a newspaper and had planned to reward herself with a weekend off, the first since she started at SMP. But the discovery that her most personal and intimate possessions had been stolen and the Borgshire report, too, made it impossible for her to relax. During a sleepless night spent mostly in the kitchen with Linda, Berger had expected the poison pen to strike, disseminating pictures of her that would be deplorably damaging. What an excellent tool the internet was for freaks.
Good grief. A video of me fucking my husband and another man. I'm going to end up on half the websites in the world.
Panic and terror had dogged her through the night. It took all of Linda's powers of persuasion to send her to bed. At 8 she got up and drove to SMP. She could not stay away. If a storm was brewing, then she wanted to face it first, before anyone else got wind of it. But in the half-staffed Saturday newsroom, everything was normal. People greeted her as she limped past the central desk. Holm was off today. Fredrickson was the acting news editor.
"Morning. I thought you were taking today off," he said.
"Me too. But I wasn't feeling well yesterday, and there are things I have to do. Anything happening?"
"No, it's pretty slow today. The hottest thing we've got is that the timber industry in Dalarna is reporting a boom. And there was a robbery in Norrköping in which one person was injured."
"Right. I'll be in the cage for a while."
She sat down, leaned her crutches against the bookshelves and logged on. First, she checked her email. She had several messages, but nothing from Poison Pen. She frowned. It had been 2 days now since the break-in, and he had not yet acted on what had to be a treasure trove of opportunities.
Why not? Maybe he's going to change tactics. Blackmail? Maybe he just wants to keep me guessing.
She had nothing specific to work on, so she clicked on the strategy document she was writing for SMP. She stared at the screen for 15 minutes, without seeing the words. She tried to call Gregor, but with no success. She did not even know if his mobile worked in other countries. Of course she could have tracked him down with a bit of effort, but she felt lazy to the core. Wrong. She felt helpless and paralysed. She tried to call Blomqvist to tell him that the Borgshire folder had been stolen, but he did not answer. By 10 she had accomplished nothing and decided to go home. She was just reaching out to shut down her computer when her ICQ account pinged. She looked in astonishment at the icon bar. She knew what ICQ was, but she seldom chatted, and she had not used the program since starting at SMP. She clicked hesitantly on answer.
"Hi, Erica." "Hi. Who's this?" "Private. Are you alone?" "A trick. Poison Pen." "Who are you?" "We met at Callie Blomqvist's place when he came home from Sandhamn."
Vega stared at the screen. It took her a few seconds to make the connection.
"Lisbeth Salander." "Impossible." "Are you there?" "Yes. No names." "You know who I am?" "How do I know this isn't a bluff? I know how Mikhail got that scar on his neck."
Berger swallowed. Only 4 people in the world knew how he had come by that scar. Salander was one of them.
"But how can you be chatting with me? I'm pretty good with computers."
"Salander is a devil with computers.
But how the hell is she managing to communicate from Sahlgrenska, where she's been isolated since April?" "I believe it." "Can I trust you?" "How do you mean?" "This conversation must not be leaked. She doesn't want the police to know she has access to the net.
Of course not. Which is why she's chatting with the editor-in-chief of one of the biggest newspapers in Sweden. No problem. What do you want? To pay my debt. What do you mean? Millennium backed me up. We were just doing our job. No other publication did. You're not guilty of what you were accused of. You have a stalker.
Berger's heart beat furiously.
What do you know?
Stolen video. Break-in.
Correct. Can you help?
Berger could not believe she was asking this question. It was absurd. Salander was in rehabilitation at Sahlgrenska and was up to her neck in her own problems. She was the most unlikely person Berger could turn to with any hope of getting help.
Dunno. Let me try. How? Question. You think the creep is at SMP? I can't prove it. Why do you think so?
Berger thought for a while before she replied.
Just a hunch. It started when I began working at SMP. Other people here have received crude messages from Poison Pen that looked as though they came from me. Poison Pen? My name for the creep. Okay. Why did you become the object of Poison Pen's attention? No idea. Is there anything to suggest that it's personal? How do you mean? How many employees are SMP? 230, give or take, including the publishing company. How many do you know personally? Can't say. I've met several journalists and other colleagues over the years. Anyone you argued with before you went to SMP? Nobody that I can think of. Anyone who might want to get revenge? Revenge? What for? Revenge is a powerful motive.
Berger stared at the screen as she tried to work out what Salander was getting at.
Still there? Yes. Why do you ask about revenge? I read Rosin's list of all the incidents you connect to Poison Pen. Why am I not surprised? And? Doesn't feel like a stalker. Why not? Stalkers are driven by sexual obsession. This looks like somebody imitating a stalker. Screwdriver in your cunt? Hello? Pure parody. You think? I've seen real stalkers. They're considerably more perverted, coarse, and grotesque. They express love and hate at the same time. This just doesn't feel right. You don't think it's perverted enough? No. Mail to Eva Carlson, all wrong. Somebody who wants to get even. Wasn't thinking along those lines. Not a stalker. Personal against you. Okay. What do you suggest? Can you trust me? Maybe. I need access to SMP's intranet. Whoa, hold everything. Now, I'm going to be moved soon and lose the net.
Berger hesitated for 10 seconds. Open up SMP to... what? A complete loony? Salander might be innocent of murder, but she was definitely not normal. But what did she have to lose?
How? I have to load a program into your computer. We have firewalls. You have to help. Start the internet. Already locked on. Explorer? Yes. I'll type an address. Copy and paste it into Explorer. Done. Now you see a list of programs. Click on Asphyxia Server and download it.
Berger followed the instruction.
Done. Start Asphyxia. Click on Install and choose Explorer.
It took 3 minutes.
Done. Okay, now you have to reboot your computer. We'll lose contact for a minute. Got you. When we reboot, I'm going to copy your hard disk to a server on the net. Okay. Restart. Talk to you soon.
Berger stared in fascination at the screen as her computer slowly rebooted. She wondered whether she was crazy. Then her ICQ pinged.
Hi again. Hi. It'll be faster if you do it. Start up the internet and copy in the address I email you. Done. Now you see a question. Click on Start. Done. Now you're asked to name the hard disk. Call it SMP-2. Done. Go and get a coffee. This is going to take a while.
Figueroa woke at 8 on Saturday morning, about 2 hours later than usual. She sat up in bed and looked at the man beside her. He was snoring.
Well, nobody's perfect.
She wondered where this affair with Blomqvist was going to lead. He was obviously not the faithful type, so no point in looking forward to a long-term relationship. She knew that much from his biography. Anyway, she was not so sure she wanted a stable relationship herself, with a partner and a mortgage and kids.
After a dozen failed relationships since her teens, she was tending towards the theory that stability was overrated. Her longest had been with a colleague in Uppsala. They had shared an apartment for 2 years. But she was not someone who went in for one-night stands, although she did think that sex was an underrated therapy for just about all ailments. And sex with Blomqvist, out of shape as he was just fine. More than just fine, actually. Plus, he was a good person. He made her want more. A summer romance? A love affair? Was she in love? She went to the bathroom and washed her face and brushed her teeth. Then she put on her shorts and a thin jacket and quietly left the apartment. She stretched and went on a 45-minute run out past Rolamsov Hospital and around Fredhöll and back via Smedsuden. She was home by 9 and discovered Blomqvist still asleep. She bent down and bit him on the ear. He opened his eyes in bewilderment.
"Good morning, darling. I need somebody to scrub my back."
He looked at her and mumbled something.
"What did you say?"
"You don't need to take a shower. You're soaked to the skin already."
"I've been running. You should come along."
"If I try to go at your pace, I'll have a heart attack on Nor Malestrand."
"Nonsense. Come on, time to get up."
He scrubbed her back and soaped her shoulders, and her hips, and her stomach, and her breasts. And after a while she completely lost interest in her shower and pulled him back to bed. They had their coffee at the outdoor cafe beside Nor Malestrand.
"You could turn out to be a bad habit," she said, "and we've only known each other a few days."
"I find you incredibly attractive, but you know that already."
"Why do you think that is?"
"Sorry, can't answer that question. I've never understood why I'm attracted to one woman and totally uninterested in another."
She smiled thoughtfully.
"I have today off," she said.
"But I don't. I have a mountain of work before the trial begins, and I've spent the last 3 evenings with you instead of getting on with it."
"What a shame."
He stood up and gave her a kiss on the cheek. She took hold of his shirt sleeve.
"Blomqvist, I'd like to spend some more time with you."
"Same here. But it's going to be a little up and down until we put this story to bed."
He walked away down Handvergarten. Berger got some coffee and watched the screen. For 53 minutes, absolutely nothing happened except that her screensaver started up from time to time. Then her ICQ pinged again.
"Ready. You have a whole bunch of shit on your hard drive, including a couple of viruses. Sorry. What's the next step? Who's the admin for SMP's intranet?" "Don't know. Probably Peter Fleming, our IT manager." "Right. What should I do?"
"Nothing. Go home."
"Just like that? I'll be in touch. Should I leave the computer on?"
But Salander was gone from her ICQ. Berger stared at the screen in frustration. Finally, she turned off the computer and went out to find a cafe where she could sit and think. Chapter 20. Saturday, June 4th. Blomqvist spent 25 minutes on the Tunnelbana changing lines and going in different directions. He finally got off a bus at Slusen, jumped on the Katarina lift up to Mosebacher, and took a circuitous route to Fiskergarten 9. He had bought bread, milk and cheese at the mini-mart next to the county council building, and he put the groceries straight into the fridge. Then he turned on Salander's computer. After a moment's thought, he also turned on his Ericsson T10. He ignored his normal mobile because he did not want to talk to anyone who was not involved in the Zalachenko story. He saw that he had missed a number of calls in the past 24 hours, 3 from Cortez, 2 from Ericsson, and several from Berger. First he called Cortez, who was in a cafe in Vasastad and had a few details to discuss, nothing urgent. Ericsson had only called, she told him, to keep in touch. Then he called Berger, whose line was busy. He opened the Yahoo group idiotic_table and found the final version of Salander's autobiographical statement. He smiled, printed out the document, and began to read it at once. Salander switched on her Palm Tungsten T3. She had spent an hour infiltrating and charting the intranet at SMP with the help of Berger's account. She had not tackled the Peter Fleming account because she did not need to have full administrator rights. What she was interested in was access to SMP's personnel files, and Berger's account had complete access to those. She fervently wished that Blomqvist had been kind enough to smuggle in her power book with a real keyboard and a 17-inch screen instead of only the handheld. She downloaded a list of everyone who worked at SMP and began to check them off. There were 223 employees, 82 of whom were women. She began by crossing off all the women. She did not exclude women on the grounds of their being incapable of such folly, but statistics showed that the absolute majority of people who harassed women were men. That left 141 individuals. Statistics also argued that the majority of poison pen artists were either teenagers or middle-aged. Since SMP did not have any teenagers on its staff, she drew an age curve and deleted everyone over 55 and under 25. That left 103. She thought for a moment. She did not have much time, maybe not even 24 hours. She made a snap decision. She eliminated all employees in distribution, advertising, the photo department, maintenance, and IT. She focused on a group of journalists and editorial staff, 48 men between the ages of 26 and 54. Then she heard the rattle of a set of keys. She turned off the palm and put it under the covers between her thighs. This would be her last Saturday lunch at Sahlgrenska. She took stock of the cabbage stew with resignation. After lunch she would not, she knew, be able to work undisturbed for a while. She put the palm in the recess behind the bedside table and waited, while two Eritrean women vacuumed the room and changed her bed linen. One of the women had regularly smuggled in a few Marlboro lights for Salander during the past month. She had also given her a lighter, now hidden behind the bedside table. Salander gratefully accepted two cigarettes, which she planned to smoke by the vent window during the night. Not until 2 p.m. was everything quiet again in her room. She took out the palm and connected to the net. She had intended to go straight back to SMP's administration, but she also had to deal with her own problems. She made her daily sweep, starting with the Yahoo group idiotic_table. She saw that Blomqvist had not uploaded anything new for 3 days, and wondered what he was working on. The son of a bitch is probably out screwing around with some bimbo with big boobs. She then proceeded to the Yahoo group the_knights, and checked whether Plague had added anything. He had not. Then she checked the hard drives of Ekstrom, some routine correspondence about the trial, and Teleborian. Every time she accessed Teleborian's hard drive, she felt as if her body temperature dropped a few degrees. She found that he had already written her forensic psychiatric report, even though he was obviously not supposed to write it until after he had been given the opportunity to examine her. He had brushed up his prose, but there was nothing much new. She downloaded the report and sent it off to idiotic_table. She checked Teleborian's emails from the past 24 hours, clicking through one after another. She almost missed the terse message, "Saturday, 3, at the Ring in Central Station, Jonas." Shit, Jonas. He was mentioned in a lot of correspondence with Teleborian, used a Hotmail account, not identified. Salander glanced at the digital clock on her bedside table. 2:28. She immediately pinged Blomqvist's ICQ. No response. Blomqvist printed out the 220 pages of the manuscript that were finished. Then he shut off the computer and sat down at Salander's kitchen table with a red pencil. He was pleased with the text, but there was still a gigantic, gaping hole. How could he find the remainder of the section? Erickson might be right. It might be impossible. He was running out of time. Salander swore in frustration and pinged Plague. He did not answer either. She looked again at the clock. 2:30. She sat on the edge of the bed and tried Cortez next, and then Erickson. "Saturday. Everybody's off work." 2:32. Then she tried to reach Berger. "No luck. I told her to go home. Shit." 2:33. She should be able to send a text message to Blomqvist's mobile, but it was tapped. She bit her lip. Finally, in desperation, she rang for the nurse. It was 2:35 when she heard the key in the lock, and Nurse Agneta looked in on her. "Hello, are you okay?"
"Is Dr. Jonasson on duty?"
"Aren't you feeling well?"
"I feel fine, but I need to have a few words with him, if possible."
"I just saw him a little while ago. What's it about?"
"I just have to talk to him."
Nurse Agneta frowned. Lisbeth Salander had seldom rung for a nurse if she did not have a severe headache or some other equally serious problem. She never pestered them for anything and had never before asked to speak to a specific doctor.
but Nurse Agneta had noticed that Dr. Jonasson had spent time with a patient who was under arrest and otherwise seemed withdrawn from the world. It was possible that he had established some sort of rapport.
"I'll find out if he has time," Nurse Agneta said gently, and closed the door.
And then locked it. It was 2:36, and then the clock clicked over to 2:37. Salander got up from the edge of the bed and went to the window. She kept an eye on the clock. 2:39. 2:40. At 2:44 she heard steps in the corridor, and the rattle of the Securitas guard's key ring. Jonasson gave her an inquisitive glance and stopped in his tracks when he saw her desperate look.
"Has something happened?"
"Something is happening right now. Do you have a mobile on you?"
"A what?"
"A mobile. I have to make a call."
Jonasson looked over his shoulder at the door.
"Anders, I need a mobile. Now!"
When he heard the desperation in her voice, he dug into his pants pocket and handed her his Motorola. Salander grabbed it from him. She could not call Blomqvist because he had not given her the number of his Ericsson T10. It had never come up, and he had never supposed that she would be able to call him from her isolation. She hesitated a tenth of a second and punched in Berger's number. It rang three times before Berger answered. Berger was in her BMW, half a mile from home in Salzschabaden, when her mobile rang.
"Berger? Salander, no time to explain. Do you have the number of Mikhail's second mobile, the one that's not tapped?"
"Yes."
Salander had already surprised her once today.
"Call him. Now. Teleborian is meeting Jonas at the ring in Central Station at 3.
"What? Just hurry. Teleborian, Jonas, the ring in Central Station 3. He has 15 minutes.
Salander flipped the phone shut so that Berger would not be tempted to waste precious seconds with unnecessary questions. Berger pulled over to the curb. She reached for the address book in her bag and found the number Blomqvist had given her the night they met at Samir's cauldron. Blomqvist heard his mobile beeping. He got up from the kitchen table, went to Salander's office and picked up the phone from the desk.
"Yes?"
"Erika."
"Hi."
"Teleborian is meeting Jonas at the ring in Central Station at 3. You only have a few minutes."
"What? What? What?"
"Teleborian, I heard you. How'd you know about that?
Stop arguing and make it snappy."
Mikhail glanced at the clock. 2:47.
"Thanks. Bye."
He grabbed his laptop case and took the stairs instead of waiting for the elevator. As he ran, he called Cortez on his T10.
"Cortez?"
"Where are you now?"
"At the Academy bookshop."
"Teleborian is meeting Jonas at the ring in Central Station at 3. I'm on my way, but you're closer."
"Oh, boy, I'm on my way."
Blomqvist jogged down to Gurtgarten and sped up towards Slussen. When he reached Slussplan, he was badly out of breath. Maybe Figueroa had a point. He was not going to make it. He looked around for a taxi. Salander handed the mobile back to Dr. Jonasson.
"Thanks," she said.
"Teleborian?"
Jonasson could not help overhearing the name. She met his gaze.
"Teleborian is a real, real bastard. You have no idea."
"No, but I could see that something happened just now that got you more agitated than I've seen you in all the time you've been in my care. I hope you know what you're doing." Salander gave Jonasson a lopsided smile.
"You should have the answer to that question very soon," she said.
Cortez left the Academy bookshop running like a madman. He crossed Sveavägen on the viaduct at Mr. Samuelsgatan and went straight down to Klara Norra, where he turned up the Klaraberg viaduct and across Vasagatan. He flew across Klarabergsgatan and between a bus and two cars, one of whose drivers punched his windshield in fury, and through the doors of Central Station as the station clock ticked over to 3 sharp. He took the escalator 3 steps at a time down to the main ticket hall and jogged past the pocket bookshop before slowing down so as not to attract attention. He scanned every face of every person standing or walking near the ring. He did not see Teleborian, or the man Mom had photographed outside Café Copacabana, whom they believed to be Jonas. He looked back at the clock. 3:01. He was gasping as if he had just run a marathon. He took a chance and hurried across the hall and out through the doors onto Vasagarden. He stopped and looked around, checking one face after another as far as his eyes could see. No Teleborian. No Jonas. He turned back into the station. 3:03. The ring area was almost deserted. Then he looked up and got a split-second's glimpse of Teleborian's dishevelled profile and goatee as he came out of Presbyron on the other side of the ticket hall. A second later, the man from Mom's photograph materialized at Teleborian's side. Jonas. They crossed the concourse and went out onto Vasagarten by the north door. Cortez exhaled in relief. He wiped the sweat from his brow with the back of his hand and set off in pursuit of the two men. Blomqvist's taxi got to Central Station at 3:07. He walked rapidly into the ticket hall, but he could see neither Teleborian nor anyone looking like he might be Jonas. Nor Cortez, for that matter. He was about to call Cortez when the T-10 rang in his hand.
"I've got them. They're sitting in the Tre Remarie pub on Vasagarten, by the stairs down to the Acala line."
"Thanks, Henry. Where are you?"
"I'm at the bar, having my afternoon beer. I earned it."
"Very good. They know what I look like, so I'll stay out of it. I don't suppose you have any chance of hearing what they're saying."
"Not a hope. I can only see Jonas's back, and that fucking psychiatrist mumbles when he speaks, so I can't even see his lips move."
"I get it.
But we may have a problem."
"What's that?"
"Jonas has put his wallet and mobile on the table, and he put his car keys on top of the wallet."
"Okay, I'll handle it."
Figueroa's mobile played the theme from Once Upon a Time in the West. She put down her book about God in antiquity. It did not seem as though she would ever be able to finish it.
"Hi, it's me, Carr. What are you up to?"
"I'm sitting at home sorting through my collection of photographs of old lovers. I was ignominiously ditched earlier today."
"Do you have a car nearby?"
"The last time I checked, it was in the parking space outside."
"Good. Do you feel like an afternoon on the town?"
"Not particularly. What's going on?"
"A psychiatrist named Teleborian is having a beer with an undercover agent, codename Jonas, down on Vasagarten. And since I'm cooperating with your Stasi-style bureaucracy, I thought you might be amused to tag along."
Figueroa was on her feet and reaching for her car keys.
"This is not your little joke, is it?"
"Hardly. And Jonas has his car keys on the table in front of him."
"I'm on my way."
Ericsson did not answer the phone, but Blomqvist got lucky and caught Karim, who'd been at Olhem's department store, buying a birthday present for her husband. He asked her to please, on overtime, hurry over to the pub as backup for Cortez. Then he called Cortez.
"Here's the plan. I'll have a car in place in 5 minutes. It'll be on Jernvigsgarten, down the street from the pub. Lotte is going to join you in a few minutes as backup."
"Good.
When they leave the pub, you tell Jonas. Keep me posted by mobile. As soon as you see him approach a car, we have to know. Lotte will follow Teleborian. If we don't get there in time, make a note of his registration number."
"Okay."
Figueroa parked beside the Nordic Light Hotel next to the Arlanda Express platforms. Blomqvist opened the driver's door a minute later.
"Which pub are they in?"
Blomqvist told her.
"I have to call for backup."
"I'd rather you didn't. We've got them covered. Too many cooks might wreck the whole dish."
Figueroa gave him a skeptical look.
"And how did you know that this meeting was going to take place?"
"I have to protect my source, sorry."
"Do you have your own fucking intelligence service at Millennium?"
she burst out. Blomqvist looked pleased. It was cool to outdo Seppo in their own field of expertise. In fact, he did not have the slightest idea how Berger came to call him out of the blue to tell him of the meeting. She had not had access to ongoing editorial work at Millennium since early April. She knew about Teleborian, to be sure, but Jonas had not come into the picture until May. As far as he knew, Berger had not even known of his existence, let alone that he was the focus of intense speculation both at Seppo and at Millennium. He needed to talk to Berger. Salander pressed her lips together and looked at the screen of her handheld. After using Jonasson's mobile, she had pushed all thoughts of the section to one side and concentrated on Berger's problem. She had next, after careful consideration, eliminated all the men in the 26 to 54 age group who were married. She was working with a broad brush, of that she was perfectly aware. The selection was scarcely based on any statistical, sociological, or scientific rationale. Poison Pen might easily be a married man with 5 children and a dog. He might also be a man who worked in maintenance. He could even be a woman. She simply needed to prune the number of names on the list, and her group was down from 48 to 18 since her latest cut. The list was made up largely of the better-known reporters, managers or middle managers aged 35 or older. If she did not find anything of interest in that group, she could always widen the net again. At 4, she logged on to Hacker Republic and uploaded the list to Plague. He pinged her a few minutes later.
18 names. What is this?
A little project on the side. Consider it a training exercise.
Okay, I guess.
One of the guys on the list is a stalker. Find him.
What are the parameters?
Have to work fast. Tomorrow they're pulling the plug on me. Need to find him before then.
She outlined the poison pen situation.
Is there any profit in this?
Yes. I won't come out to the swamp and set your place on fire.
Would you really?
I pay you every time I ask you to do something for me. This isn't me. View it as a tax write-off.
You're beginning to exhibit signs of a social conscience.
Oh, yeah?
She sent him the access codes for SMP's newsroom and then logged off from ICQ. It was 4:20 before Cortez called.
They're showing signs of leaving.
We're ready.
Silence.
They're going their separate ways outside the pub. Jonas heading north, Teleborian south. Lotta's going after him.
Blomqvist raised a finger and pointed as Jonas flashed past them on Vasagarten. Figueroa nodded and started the engine. Seconds later, Blomqvist could also see Cortez.
He's crossing Vasagarten, heading towards Kungsgarten,
Cortez said into his mobile.
Keep your distance, so he doesn't spot you.
Quite a few people out.
Silence.
He's turning north on Kungsgarten.
North on Kungsgarten, Blomqvist said.
Figueroa changed gears and turned up Vasagarten. They were stopped by a red light.
Where is he now?
Blomqvist said as they turned onto Kungsgarten.
Opposite PUB department store. He's walking fast.
Whoops, he's turned up Drottninggarten, heading north.
Drottninggarten heading north, Blomqvist said.
Right,
Figueroa said, making an illegal turn onto Clara Nora and heading towards Olaf Palmesgata. She turned and braked outside the SIF building. Jonas crossed Olaf Palmesgata and turned up towards Sveavägen. Cortez stayed on the other side of the street.
He turned east.
We can see you both.
He's turning down Hollandegarten.
Hello?
Car, red Audi.
Car,
Blomqvist said, writing down the registration number Cortez read off to him.
Which way is he facing? Figueroa said.
Facing south, Cortez reported. He's pulling out in front of you on Olaf Palmesgata now.
Monica was already on her way and passing Drottninggarten. She signalled and headed off a couple of pedestrians who tried to sneak across, even though their light was red.
Thanks, Henry. We'll take it from here.
The red Audi turned south on Sveavägen. As Figueroa followed, she flipped open her mobile with her left hand and punched in a number.
Can I get an owner of a red Audi? She said, rattling off the number. Jonas Sandberg, born 1971. What did you say? Helsingorsgarten, Kista?
Thanks.
Blomqvist wrote down the information. They followed the red Audi via Hamngarten to Strandvägen and then straight up to Artilleriegarten. Jonas parked a block away from the Armé Museum. He walked across the street and through the front door of an 1890s building.
Interesting,
Figueroa said, turning to Blomqvist. Jonas Sandberg had entered a building that was only a block away from the apartment the Prime Minister had borrowed for their private meeting.
Nicely done, Figueroa said.
Just then Karim called and told them that Teleborian had gone up onto Klarabergsgarten via the escalators in Central Station and from there to police headquarters on Kungsholmen.
Police headquarters at 5 on a Saturday afternoon?
Figueroa and Blomqvist exchanged a sceptical look. Monica pondered this turn of events for a few seconds, then she picked up her mobile and called Criminal Inspector Jan Boblanski.
Hello, it's Monica from SIS. We met on Nordmalestrand a while back.
What do you want? Boblanski said.
Do you have anybody on duty this weekend?
Modig,
Boblanski said.
I need a favour. Do you know if she's at headquarters?
I doubt it. It's beautiful weather and Saturday afternoon.
Could you possibly reach her or anyone else on the investigative team who might be able to take a look in Prosecutor Ekstrom's hallway to see if there's a meeting going on in his office at the moment?
What sort of meeting?
I can't explain just yet. I just need to know if he's in a meeting with anybody right now, and if so, who?
You want me to spy on a prosecutor who happens to be my superior?
Figueroa paused.
Yes, I do.
I'll do what I can, he said, and hung up.
Sonia Modig was closer to police headquarters than Bublansky had thought. She was having coffee with her husband on the balcony of a friend's place in Wasserstaden. Their children were away with her parents, who had taken them on a week's vacation, and they planned to do something as old-fashioned as have a bite to eat and go to the movies. Bublansky explained why he was calling.
"And what sort of excuse would I have to barge in on Ekstrom?" Modig asked.
"I promised to give him an update on Niedermann yesterday, but in fact I forgot to deliver it to his office before I left. It's on my desk."
"Okay," said Modig. She looked at her husband and her friend. "I have to go into HQ. I'll take the car, and with a little luck I'll be back in an hour."
Her husband sighed. Her friend sighed.
"I'm on call this weekend," Modig said in apology.
She parked on Bergsgarten, took the elevator up to Bublansky's office, and picked up the three pages that comprised the meager results of their search for Niedermann. Not much to hang on the Christmas tree, she thought. She took the stairs up to the next floor and stopped at the door to the hallway. Headquarters was almost deserted on this summer afternoon. She was not exactly sneaking around. She was just walking very quietly. She stopped outside Ekstrom's closed door. She heard voices, and all of a sudden her courage deserted her. She felt like a fool. In any normal situation, she would have knocked on the door, pushed it open, and exclaimed, "Hello? So you're still here?" and then sailed right in. Now it seemed all wrong. She looked around. Why had Bublansky called her? What was this meeting about? She glanced across the hall. Opposite Ekstrom's office was a conference room big enough for 10 people. She had sat through a number of presentations there herself. She went into the room and closed the door. The blinds were down, and the glass partition to the hallway was covered by curtains. It was dark. She pulled up a chair and sat down, then opened the curtains a crack so that she would have a view of the hallway. She felt uneasy. If anyone opened the door, she would have quite a problem explaining what she was doing there. She took out her mobile and looked at the time display. Just before 6. She set the phone to vibrate and leaned back in her chair, watching the door of Ekstrom's office. At 7, Plague pinged Salander.
"Okay, I'm the admin for SMP.
"Where?"
He sent over a URL.
"We won't be able to make it in 24 hours, even if we have email addresses for all 18. It's going to take days to hack their home PCs. Most probably aren't even online on a Saturday night."
"Concentrate on their home PCs and I'll take care of the ones at SMP.
"I thought of that. Your palm is a bit limited. Anything you want me to focus on?"
"No, just try them."
"Okay."
"Plague?"
"Yeah."
"If we don't find anything by tomorrow, I want you to keep at it."
"Okay."
"In which case I'll pay you."
"Forget about it. This is just fun."
She logged out and went to the URL where Plague had uploaded all the administrator rights for SMP. She started by checking whether Fleming was online and at work. He was not. So she borrowed his identity and went into SMP's mail server. That way she could look at all the activity in the email system, even messages that had long since been deleted from individual accounts. She started with Ernst Theodor Billinger, one of the night editors at SMP, 43 years old. She opened his mail and began to click back in time. She spent about 2 seconds on each message, just long enough to get an idea of who had sent it and what it was about. After a few minutes, she had worked out what was routine mail in the form of daily memos, schedules, and other uninteresting stuff. She started to scroll past these. She went through 3 months' worth of messages one by one. Then she skipped month to month and read the subject lines, opening the message only if it was something that caught her attention. She learned that Billinger was going out with a woman named Sophia, and that he used an unpleasant tone with her. She saw that this was nothing unusual, since Billinger took an unpleasant tone with most of the people to whom he wrote messages, reporters, layout artists, and others. Even so, she thought it odd that a man would consistently address his girlfriend with the words "fucking fatty," "fucking airhead," or "fucking cunt." After an hour of searching, she shut down Billinger and crossed him off the list. She moved on to Lars Orjan Volberg, a veteran reporter of 51, who was on the legal desk. Ed Klinth walked into police headquarters at 7:30 on Saturday evening. Figueroa and Blomqvist were waiting for him. They were sitting at the same conference table at which Blomqvist had sat the day before.
at length reminded himself that he was on very thin ice, and that a host of regulations had been violated when he gave Blomqvist access to the hallway. Figueroa most definitely had no right to invite him here on her own authority. Even the spouses of his colleagues were not permitted in the halls of SIS, but were asked instead to wait on the landings if they were meeting their partner. And to cap it all, Blomqvist was a journalist. From now on, Blomqvist would be allowed only into the temporary office at Fridhelmsplan. But outsiders were allowed into the hallways by special invitation. Foreign guests, researchers, academics, freelance consultants. He put Blomqvist into the category of freelance consultant. All this nonsense about security classification was little more than words anyway. Someone decides that a certain person should be given a particular level of clearance, and Edlinth had decided that if criticism were raised, he would say that he personally had given Blomqvist clearance. If something went wrong, that is. He sat down and looked at Figueroa.
How did you find out about the meeting?
Blomqvist called me at around 3, she said with a satisfied smile. Edklinth turned to Blomqvist.
And how did you find out about the meeting?
Tipped off by a source.
Am I to conclude that you're running some sort of surveillance on Teleborian?
Figueroa shook her head. That was my first thought, too, she said in a cheerful voice, as if Blomqvist were not in the room. But it doesn't add up. Even if somebody were following Teleborian for Blomqvist, that person could not have known in advance that he was on his way to meet Jonas Sandberg.
So what else? Illegal tapping or something?
Edklinth said.
I can assure you, Blomqvist said, to remind him that he was there in the room, that I'm not conducting illegal eavesdropping on anyone. Be realistic. Illegal tapping is the domain of government authorities.
Edklinth frowned.
So you aren't going to tell us how you heard about this meeting?
I've already told you that I won't. I was tipped off by a source. The source is protected. Why don't we concentrate on what we've discovered?
I don't like loose ends, Edklinth said. But okay. What have you found out?
His name is Jonas Sandberg, Figueroa said, trained as a Navy frogman, and then attended the police academy in the early 90s. Worked first in Uppsala and then in Södertälje.
You're from Uppsala?
Yes, but we missed each other by about a year. He was recruited by SIS counter-espionage in 1998, reassigned to a secret post abroad in 2000. According to our documents, he's at the embassy in Madrid. I checked with the embassy. They have no record of a Jonas Sandberg on their staff.
Just like Mortensen. Officially moved to a place where he doesn't exist.
The chief of secretariat is the only person who could make this sort of arrangement.
And in normal circumstances, everything would be dismissed as muddled red tape. We've noticed it only because we're specifically looking for it. And if anyone starts asking awkward questions, they'll say it's confidential, or that it has something to do with terrorism.
There's quite a bit of budget work to check up on.
The chief of budget?
Maybe.
Anything else?
Sandberg lives in Sollentuna. He's not married, but he has a child with a teacher in Södertälje. No black marks on his record. License for 2 handguns. Conscientious and a teetotaler. The only thing that doesn't quite fit is that he seems to be an evangelical and was a member of the Word of Life in the 90s.
Where did you find that out?
I had a word with my old chief in Uppsala. He remembers Sandberg quite well.
A Christian frogman with 2 weapons and offspring in Södertälje. More?
We only ID'd him about 3 hours ago. This is pretty fast work, you have to admit.
Fair enough. What do we know about the building on Artillery Garden?
Not a lot yet. Stefan went to chase someone up from the city building office. We have blueprints of the building. 6 floors with a total of 22 apartments, plus 8 apartments in a small building in the courtyard. I looked up the tenants, but didn't find anything that stood out. 2 of the people living in the building have police records.
Who are they?
Lindstrom on the 2nd floor, 63, convicted of insurance fraud in the 70s. Wittfeldt on the 4th floor, 47, twice convicted for beating his ex-wife. Otherwise, what sounds like a cross-section of middle-class Sweden. There's one apartment that raises a question mark, though.
What?
It's on the top floor. 11 rooms and apparently a bit of a snazzy joint. It's owned by a company called Bellona, Inc.
And what's their stated business?
God only knows. They do marketing analyses and have annual sales of around 30 million kroner. All the owners live abroad.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh what?
Nothing. Just uh-huh.
Do some more checks on Bellona." At that moment, the officer Blomqvist knew only as Stefan entered the room. "Hi, Chief," he greeted Ed Clint. "This is really cool. I checked out the story behind the Bellona apartment." "And?" Figueroa said. "Bellona Inc. was founded in the 70s. They bought the apartment from the estate of the former owner, a woman by the name of Christina Sederholm, born in 1917, married to Hans Wilhelm Franke, the loose cannon who quarrelled with P.G. Winger at the time SAS was founded."
"Good," Ed Clint said. "Very good. Monica, we want surveillance on that apartment around the clock. Find out what phones they have. I want to know who goes in and who comes out and what vehicles drop anyone off at that address. The usual."
Ed Clint turned to Blomqvist. He looked as if he wanted to say something, but he restrained himself. Blomqvist looked at him expectantly.
"Are you satisfied with the information flow?"
Ed Clint said at last.
"Very satisfied. Are you satisfied with Millennium's contribution?"
Ed Clint nodded reluctantly.
"You don't know that I could get into very deep water for this."
"Not because of me. I regard the information that I receive here as source protected. I'll report the facts, but I won't mention how or where I got them. Before I go to press, I'm going to do a formal interview with you. If you don't want to give me an answer to something, you just say no comment, or else you could expound on what you think about the section for special analysis. It's up to you."
"Indeed,"
Ed Clint nodded. Blomqvist was happy. Within a few hours, the section had taken on tangible form. A real breakthrough. To Modig's great frustration, the meeting in Ekstrom's office was lasting a long time. Mercifully, someone had left a full bottle of mineral water on the conference table. She had twice texted her husband to tell him that she was still held up, promising to make it up to him as soon as she could get home. She was starting to get restless and felt like an intruder. The meeting did not end until 7:30. She was taken completely by surprise when the door opened and Faster came out. And then Dr. Teleborian. Behind them came an older, grey-haired man Modig had never seen before. Finally, Prosecutor Ekstrom, putting on a jacket as he switched off the lights and locked the door to his office. Modig held up her mobile to the gap in the curtains and took two low-res photographs of the group outside Ekstrom's door. Seconds later, they had set off down the hall. She held her breath until they were some distance from the conference room in which she was trapped. She was in a cold sweat by the time she heard the door to the stairwell close. She stood up, weak at the knees. Bublansky called Figueroa just after 8.
"You wanted to know if Ekstrom had a meeting?"
"Correct," Figueroa said.
"It just ended. Ekstrom met with Dr. Peter Teleborian, my former colleague Criminal Inspector Faster, and an older gentleman we didn't recognize."
"Just a moment," Figueroa said. She put her hand over the mouthpiece and turned to the others. "Teleborian went straight to Ekstrom."
"Hello, are you still there?"
"Sorry, do we have a description of the third man?"
"Even better. I'm sending you a picture."
"A picture? I'm in your debt."
"It would help if you'd tell me what's going on."
"I'll get back to you."
They sat in silence around the conference table for a moment.
"So," Ed Clint said at last, "Teleborian meets with the section and then goes directly to see Prosecutor Ekstrom. I'll give a lot of money to find out what they talked about."
"Or you could just ask me," Blomqvist said.
Ed Clint and Figueroa looked at him.
"They met to finalize their strategy for nailing Salander at her trial."
Figueroa gave him a look. Then she nodded slowly.
"That's a guess," Ed Clint said, "unless you happen to have paranormal abilities."
"It's no guess," said Mikhail. "They met to discuss the forensic psychiatric report on Salander. Teleborian has just finished writing it."
"Nonsense! Salander hasn't even been examined."
Blomqvist shrugged and opened his laptop case.
"That hasn't stopped Teleborian in the past. Here's the latest version. It's dated, as you can see, the week the trial is scheduled to begin."
Ed Clint and Figueroa read through the report before them. At last, they exchanged glances and then looked at Blomqvist.
"And where the devil did you get a hold of this?"
Ed Clint said.
"From a source I have to protect," said Blomqvist.
"Blomqvist, we have to be able to trust each other. You're withholding information. Do you have any more surprises up your sleeve?"
"Yes, I do have secrets, of course.
just as I'm persuaded that you haven't given me carte blanche to look at everything you have here at Seppo.
It's not the same thing.
It's precisely the same thing. This arrangement involves cooperation. You said it yourself. We have to trust each other. I'm not holding back anything that could be useful to your investigation of the section, or could throw light on the various crimes that have been committed. I've already handed over evidence that Teleborian committed crimes with Burek in 1991, and I told you that he would be hired to do the same thing again now. And this is the document that proves me right.
But you're still withholding key material.
Naturally. And you can either suspend our cooperation, or you can live with that. Figueroa held up a diplomatic finger.
Excuse me, but does this mean that Ekstrom is working for the section?
Blomqvist frowned.
That I don't know. My sense is that he's more a useful fool being used by the section. He's ambitious, but I think he's honest, if a little stupid. One source did tell me that he swallowed most of what Teleborian fed him about Salander at a presentation of reports when the hunt with her was still on.
So you don't think it takes much to manipulate him?
Exactly. And Criminal Inspector Faster is an unadulterated idiot who believes that Salander is a lesbian Satanist.
Berger was at home. She felt paralyzed and unable to concentrate on any real work. All the time she expected someone to call and tell her that pictures of her were posted on some website. She caught herself thinking over and over about Salander, although she realized that her hopes of getting help from her were most likely in vain. Salander was locked up at Sahlgrenska. She was not allowed visitors and could not even read the newspapers. But she was an oddly resourceful young woman. Despite her isolation, she had managed to contact Berger on ICQ and then by phone. And 2 years ago she had single-handedly destroyed Venestrom's financial empire and saved Millennium. At 8, Linda arrived and knocked on the door. Berger jumped as though someone had fired a shot in her living room.
"Hello, Erica. You're sitting here in the dark, looking glum."
Berger nodded and turned on a light.
"Hi. I'll put on some coffee."
"No,
let me do it. Anything new?" "You can say that again. Lisbeth Salander got in touch with me and took control of my computer, and then she called to say that Teleborian and somebody named Jonas were meeting at Central Station this afternoon." "No, nothing new," she said, "but I have something I'd like to bounce off you."
"Go ahead."
"What do you think the chances are that this isn't a stalker, but somebody I know who wants to fuck with me?"
"What's the difference?"
"To me, a stalker is someone I don't know who's become fixated on me. The alternative is a person who wants to take some sort of revenge and sabotage my life for personal reasons."
"Interesting thought. Why did this come up?"
"I was discussing the situation with someone today. I can't give you her name, but she suggested that threats from a real stalker would be different. She said a stalker would never have written the email to the girl on the culture desk. It seems completely beside the point."
Linda said, "There is something to that. You know, I never read the emails.
Could I see them?"
Berger set up her laptop on the kitchen table. Figueroa escorted Blomqvist out of police headquarters at 10 p.m. They stopped at the same place in Kronoberg Park as the day before.
"Here we are again. Are you going to disappear to work, or do you want to come to my place and come to bed with me?"
"Well..."
"You don't have to feel pressured, Mikhail. If you have to work, then do it."
"Listen, Figueroa. You're worryingly habit-forming."
"And you don't want to be dependent on anything. Is that what you're saying?"
"No, that's not what I'm saying. But there's someone I have to talk to tonight, and it'll take a while. You'll be asleep before I'm done." She shrugged. "See you." He kissed her cheek and headed for the bus stop on Friedemsplan.
"Blomqvist," she called.
"What?"
"I'm free tomorrow morning as well. Come and have breakfast if you can."
Chapter 21. Saturday, June 4th to Monday, June 6th. Salander picked up a number of ominous vibrations as she browsed the emails of the news editor Holm. He was 58 and thus fell outside the group, but Salander had included him anyway because he and Berger had been at each other's throats. He was a schemer who wrote messages to various people telling them how someone had done a rotten job. It was obvious to Salander that Holm did not like Berger, and he suddenly wasted a lot of space talking about how the bitch had said this or done that. he used the net exclusively for work-related sites. If he had other interests, he must Google them in his own time on some other machine. She kept him as a candidate for the title of Poison Pen, but he was not a favourite. Salander spent some time thinking about why she did not believe he was one, and arrived at the conclusion that he was so damned arrogant he did not have to go to the trouble of using anonymous email. If he wanted to call Berger a whore, he would do it openly. And he did not seem the type to go sneaking into Berger's home in the middle of the night. At 10 in the evening she took a break and went into idiotic_table. She saw that Blomqvist had not come back yet. She felt slightly peeved and wondered what he was up to and whether he had made it in time to Teleborian's meeting. Then she went back into SMP's server. She moved to the next name on the list, assistant sports editor Klaas Lundin, 29. She had just opened his email when she stopped and bit her lip. She closed it again and went instead to Berger's. She scrolled back in time. There was relatively little in Berger's inbox, since her email account had only been opened on May 2nd. The very first message was a midday memo from Peter Fredriksson. In the course of Berger's first day, several people had emailed her to welcome her to SMP. Salander carefully read each message in Berger's inbox. She could see how even from day one there had been a hostile undertone in her correspondence with Holm. They seemed unable to agree on anything, and Salander saw that Holm was already trying to exasperate Berger by sending several emails about complete trivialities. She skipped over ads, spam, and news memos. She focused on any kind of personal correspondence. She read budget calculations, advertising and marketing projections, an exchange with CFO Selberg that went on for a week and was virtually a brawl over staff layoffs. Berger had received irritated messages from the head of the legal department about some temp by the name of Johannes Frisk. She had apparently assigned him to work on some story, and this had not been appreciated. It seemed as if no one at management level could see anything positive in any of Berger's arguments or proposals. After a while, Salander scrolled back to the beginning and did a statistical calculation in her head. Of all the upper-level managers at SMP, only four did not engage in sniping. They were CEO Magnus Borgshaw, assistant editor Fredriksson, assistant front-page editor Magnusson, and cultural editor Sebastian Strandlund. Had they never heard of women at SMP? All the heads of department were men. Of these, the one that Berger had least to do with was Strandlund. She had exchanged only two emails with the cultural editor. The friendliest and most engaging messages came from assistant front-page editor Gunnar Magnusson. Borgshaw's were terse and to the point. Why the hell had this group of boys hired Berger at all, if all they did was tear her limb from limb? The colleague Berger seemed to have the most to do with was Fredriksson. His role was to act as a kind of shadow, to sit in on her meetings as an observer. He prepared memos, briefed Berger on various articles and issues, and got the jobs moving. He emailed Berger a dozen times a day. Salander sorted all of Fredriksson's emails to Berger and read them through. In a number of instances, he had objected to some decision Berger had made and presented counter-proposals. Berger seemed to have confidence in him, since she would then often change her decision or accept his argument. He was never hostile, but there was not a hint of any personal relationship to her. Salander closed Berger's email and thought for a moment. She opened Fredriksson's account. Plague had been fooling around with the home computers of various employees of SMP all evening without much success. He had managed to get into Holmes' machine because it had an open line to his desk at work. Any time of the day or night he could go in and access whatever he was working on. Holmes' PC was one of the most boring Plague had ever hacked. He had no luck with the other 17 names on Salander's list. One reason was that none of the people he tried to hack was online on a Saturday night. He was beginning to tire of this impossible task when Salander pinged him at 10:30.
"What's up?"
"Peter Fredriksson."
"Okay."
"Forget the others. Focus on him."
"Why?"
"Just a hunch."
"This is going to take a while."
"There's a shortcut. Fredriksson is assistant editor and uses a program called Integrator to keep track of what's happening on his work computer from home."
"I don't know anything about Integrator."
"A little program that was released a couple of years ago. It's obsolete now. Integrator has a bug. It's in the archive at Hacker Rep. In theory, you could reverse the program and get into his home computer from SMP.
Plague sighed. This girl who'd once been his student now had a better handle on things than he did.
Okay, I'll try.
If you find anything and I'm not online, give it to Kalle Blomqvist.
Blomqvist was back at Salander's apartment on Mosebacher just before midnight. He was tired. He took a shower and put on some coffee, and then he booted up Salander's computer and pinged her ICQ.
It's about time.
Sorry.
Where have you been the past few days?
Having sex with a secret agent. And chasing Jonas.
Did you make it to the meeting?
Yep. You tipped off Erica?
Only way to reach you.
Smart.
I'm being moved to prison tomorrow.
I know.
Plague's going to help out on the net.
Good.
So all that's left is the finale.
Sally, we're going to do what we have to do.
I know. You're predictable.
As always, my little charmer.
Is there anything else that I need to know?
No.
In that case, I have a lot of work to finish up online.
Good luck.
Linda woke with a start when her earpiece beeped. Someone had just tripped the motion detector she had placed in the hall on the ground floor. She propped herself up on her elbow. It was 5:23 on Sunday morning. She slipped silently out of bed and pulled on her jeans, a T-shirt, and sneakers. She stuffed the mace in her back pocket and picked up her spring-loaded baton. She passed the door to Berger's bedroom without a sound, noticing that it was closed and therefore locked. She stopped at the top of the stairs and listened. She heard a faint clinking sound and movement from the ground floor. Slowly she went down the stairs and paused in the hall to listen again. A chair scraped in the kitchen. She held the baton in a firm grip and crept to the kitchen door. She saw a bald, unshaven man sitting at the kitchen table with a glass of orange juice, reading SMP. He sensed her presence and looked up.
"And who the hell are you?"
Linda relaxed and leaned against the door jamb.
"Gregor Beckman, I presume. Hello, I'm Suzanne Linda."
"I see. Are you going to hit me over the head, or would you like a glass of juice?"
"Yes, please," Linda said, putting down her baton. "Juice, that is."
Beckman reached for a glass from the draining board and poured some for her.
"I work for Milton Security," Linda said. "I think it's probably best if your wife explains what I'm doing here."
Beckman stood up. "Has something happened to Erica?"
"Your wife is fine, but there's been some trouble. We tried to get a hold of you in Paris."
"Paris? Why Paris? I've been in Helsinki, for God's sake."
"All right. I'm sorry, but your wife thought you were in Paris."
"That's next month,"
said Beckman, on his way out the door.
"The bedroom is locked. You need a code to open the door," Linda said.
"I beg your pardon? What code?"
She told him the three numbers he had to punch in to open the bedroom door. He ran up the stairs.